Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies proved 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com.
Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of today's broadcast with Leila Mudin, who's our Hoffman Center nutritionist. Each week we get together to answer your questions, and the way to get us questions is via radioprogram@AOL.com. You can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we will answer them to the best of our ability, as we're about to do today. So what's our next question, please, Leila?
Our next question comes from Tom. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Leila. I listen to your podcast all the time. I've learned so much. Thank you. My question is, I've read a lot about apple cider vinegar being beneficial in so many ways and was wondering what you thought about it. I like apple cider vinegar very much. Even though it's an acid, it actually renders as alkaline within the body. Apple cider vinegar.
That's an interesting thing, is that it tastes acidic, but it is
like
metabolized
as alkaline.
Interesting.
Yeah. Apple cider
vinegar.
So
in other words, if people think, oh, I'm going to become too acidic if I take too much of that.
No, not at all. Wow. Apple cider vinegar is very good. It also, you know, various vinegars, including apple cider vinegar, can promote probiotic growth, beneficial bacteria growth. It's wonderful for people who have constipation. I hear a lot from patients taking a tablespoon or two of apple cider vinegar and a little water, and it keeps them regular.
Why do you think that might be? Do you think it changes the flora?
I think it's changing the flora.
But it could also help as a digestive aid.
Yes.
It's
almost working a little bit like digestive enzymes.
Uh-huh.
And people love taking apple cider vinegar also for indigestion.
Okay.
So, and I love the Bragg's apple cider vinegar.
Oh, Bragg's. They make Bragg's aminos, but that's a different product.
Yes. They also make apple cider vinegar.
Okay. Now, so one caveat about vinegar is that some people are sensitive to the ferment in vinegar.
Yeah.
People who have problems around yeast. It's sort of like, they just get an adverse reaction to
that.
But that can be handled with changing the type of vinegar, using distilled vinegar. So one study that I know of was done by a colleague of mine at University of Arizona. Her name is Carol Johnson, and she did a study that it's been immemorialized on the internet as the final scientific word on apple cider vinegar. And what they found is that it actually helps to stabilize blood sugar.
Vinegars do.
And unclear why. And she, in her article, she really couldn't figure out why. But could it help with weight loss? Could it help to stabilize blood sugar and thus stabilize, sweet cravings?
I think it curbs hunger to some degree.
Right.
I'll just notice in myself, if I've got vinegar in a salad or something, I will wind up eating far less of the meal. Because of that vinegar, I'm full.
Right. I may be doing that sort of intuitively, because I start every dinner, which could be potentially a real potlatch. Once you start eating, boy, you can't stop, with a very vinegary salad. And I use like balsamic vinegar.
That's
which
nice.
I make it. I use balsamic vinegar and very pure extra virgin artisanal olive oil, which is very
the
expensive.
The kind you can drink from a glass.
Right.
It's so delicious.
Well, it's actually a little tart. It has some Americans sometimes don't like the flavor of it because the olive oil made for American palates is very bland. But these are a little tartar. They have a lot. I mean, you could wax poetic about the bouquet of these olive oils.
Uh-huh.
So the people who are olive oil tasters have all these different terms for, nutty, fruit-like, blah, blah, blah. But there's a little bit of a bitterness, a tang to the olive. Anyway, so that, and I put some garlic cloves in there, and I just keep it in a glass vial, and I just,
Lovely.
I store it at room temperature, and I splash it on my salad, which I'm being very imaginative with my salads these days. I'm using You know, some romaine, some
it's a nice
sometimes
crunchy
kale,
lettuce. Yeah.
Sometimes arugula. I'll use hearts of palm, which I really like. Sometimes I'll put some apple. I'll sprinkle some walnuts on there. Sometimes some flaxseed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes what's that red lettuce called that comes in a little?
Radicchio.
Radicchio. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which
nice,
is bitter.
Bitter taste.
Which is a bitter taste. You know, it's an acquired taste. And I'm using beets. You know, I use the super beets.
Yeah.
Powder, but I also like beets. So I'll get pickled beets or
very nice.
Use fresh beets, chop them up, put them on there. Instead of tomatoes for a change of pace. Sometimes mm-hmm. I use tomatoes when they're in season, but mostly they taste really bland.
They just do. I've given up buying tomatoes, as a matter of fact.
But you know, this now pretty soon, you know, with the summer, we'll get good tomatoes for a little while.
We'll see.
We'll pay like $5 a pound for them.
I know.
But five bucks. So I go to get these knobby looking tomatoes that I know are like the real deal tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
They're really ugly, and it'll be like that'll be $14, please. You know.
I know.
For like what? I got like three tomatoes.
That's it. Savor them.
Right. What else might I use? Sometimes some hearts of artichoke.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make it, you know, not just the old-fashioned...
your lettuce, you know, tomato, cucumber.
Lettuce, tomato, you know, that's boring, you know, so...
Yeah. It's also nice to throw some herbs in there. I love parsley and dill in a salad.
I hate parsley.
Really?
I eat almost everything under the sun, but parsley is like...
You don't like it? Do you like cilantro?
Yes.
Yeah, I love cilantro.
Not Italian parsley.
Right.
For some reason.
Right.
But I'll cook it. Once it's cooked, it's rendered neutral tasting.
Yeah. Do you prefer the curly parsley? The Chinese?
I avoid it.
No parsley for you.
No parsley for me.
No parsley for you. Okay.
It's like, don't serve me parsley.
Okay. So, Tom, there are the benefits of apple cider vinegar. Thank you for your question.
Right.
Our next question comes from Denise. I had blood work recently and my vitamin D level was 95. My MD was shocked and told me to stop taking vitamin D.
Shocked.
Vitamin D,
that
95.
Reminds me of this reminds me of the movie Casablanca, you know, where the French inspector, you know, says to Rick, he says, I am shocked that gambling would take place in your establishment.
Oh.
I am shocked. He feigns surprise that, you know, that Rick's bar condones gambling.
Oh. So my MD told me to stop taking it, but didn't say when to resume it, and I really don't want to have to...
What's the shock? What's the shock?
It's 95.
What's
her level is 95.
That's too high?
That's too high, according to her MD.
Okay, it's...
Yeah.
Right.
I'm 51. I have no health issues. It's been 3 months that I haven't taken any vitamin D, and I was wondering if you feel it's safe for me to restart taking maybe 1,000 IUs
a day? This scenario is crazy. Mm-hmm. Because, number one, you know, if I see somebody who has a blood sugar of 95, I go...
A vitamin D level of 95.
Sorry.
It's vitamin D.
Oh, excuse
of
me.
Of a 95,
I'm
yes.
I'm sorry.
So that's why her MD was shocked.
Okay. But shock...
Had her stop
shock,
taking it.
Shock is not the appropriate mm-hmm. reaction. Caution. Caution is the reaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we like to see a serum vitamin D level between 55 and 85.
That's correct.
So...
And look, I will point out, mm-hmm. and this is for the elucidation of our audience, but also... Hopefully there's some doctors listening, is that they did a recent study of 10,000 people mm-hmm. who were supplementing with vitamin D. That's a very large sample. And what they noticed was very interesting is that since 2001, they first did the study in 2001,
mm-hmm.
and then they did the study in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2012, they noticed a real spike in people's average vitamin D levels. But in 2001, there were so many people who had a vitamin D that was under 40. The vast majority of people, like 90% of people, had a vitamin D under 40. With the popularity of vitamin D, by 2012, a substantial number of people had vitamin D above mm-hmm. 40, but still, you know, 70% of people had vitamin D below 40.
Yeah.
And what they found is that among the 10,000, they only found one person suffering from vitamin D toxicity. Although a lot of people were supplementing very aggressively with vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
That person's vitamin D level was 347.
Oh.
That's really too high.
That's shocking.
And that person had hypercalcemia. They had high blood mm-hmm. calcium. How do they get there? What Were they taking 5,000 a day for too long? Is that what? No. How they got there was by taking 50,000 international units of vitamin D daily for 7 weeks straight.
Wow.
And that's how they got to, and that's a huge mistake, because we prescribe 50,000 sometimes once a week.
Yeah.
Or even twice a week for the occasional patient who really is depleted.
Who comes in with a vitamin D of seven.
Yeah, right. So I'm sorry I misunderstood the question. I thought it was blood sugar was 95.
Vitamin D,
Let's speak to the blood sugar 95. You know, blood sugar 95 would maybe an indication that there's a slight high blood sugar potentially, but because there's fluctuations in blood sugar and there's inaccuracies in measurement, the best way to determine if that's an abnormality would be due to hemoglobin A1C, which is over time.
So Denise stopped taking her vitamin D for 3 months.
Oh, that's a shame.
Was wondering if it's safe to start it again and how much.
And look, of course it's safe to start again, but I would check a level.
Yeah.
But I almost assuredly it's plummeted.
Yeah.
It's plummeted now.
After 3 months, I would think so.
In the winter, without sunlight, you know.
Possibly. It was possibly winter. I would think it's at least safe for her to take 3,000 or 4,000 IU a day. But getting the level checked is the right thing to do,
I think for maintenance, I would not be unconcerned. I would not be concerned if she took 2,000 IUs a day until she has a chance to get a blood test.
Yeah, yeah. There you go, Denise.
How did she get there? Did she describe how much she was taking to get to 95?
She did not. No, she did not.
Okay.
So.
No, that would have been interesting to see that, because I just saw today a fairly typical thing. I saw one of our patients who's been taking 5,000 for quite some time. Her blood vitamin D is 50.5.
Yes.
She's a lady who suffers from osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm taking all this vitamin D. Why is my vitamin D only 50.5, which is the mid-range between 0 and 100?
Yeah.
I said, well, it's okay. That's fine. You need at least 40 to build bone. But I said, there's so many ways in which you can malabsorb or poorly process vitamin D.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's poor absorption. And I know she had low iron, too, so maybe she doesn't have good digestive capacity, not enough hydrochloric acid, pancreatic enzymes, or maybe her digestive surfaces are not as robust in terms of transporting nutrients into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
There's genetic variations in vitamin D processing.
The vitamin D receptors.
Right. But I also see this phenomenon where people who have inflammation or fighting some sort of disease, like an infection or some form of stress, they have much higher requirements of vitamin D. And then, of course, there's the overweight phenomenon where, as with testosterone, for example, you sequester your vitamin D in your fat cells, and so there's less available to your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
lots of reasons for a vitamin D that doesn't go up.
In my office, and certainly in your, when people go down to see you, the vitamin D of 95, we don't profess shock. We just say, well, perhaps,
yeah, let's slow down the vitamin D for a while.
Right.
And then test again and bring you back to a... But ideally...
Claude Rains was the actor who delivered that famous line.
Oh,
Claude
Rains.
I am shocked that gambling would occur in your establishment.
Optimally, everybody should be checked for vitamin D twice a year, right? After summer and after winter? Because the dose will change.
Optimally, but the U.S. Public Services Task Force, which is entrusted with making...
They're too conservative.
Yeah, well, they make recommendations that affect policy.
Yeah.
They have said that it's not cost-effective to measure vitamin D.
They're saying it's not cost-effective to have mammogram. They're saying it's not cost-effective PSAs. To have pap smears. PSAs, too.
Right.
Here we go. So let's do nothing.
Let's welcome to the world of cost containment.
Yeah, that's probably really at the bottom of it.
Well, that sort of makes sense, because they're talking about 30 to 50% hikes in Obamacare premiums.
Oh, yeah.
That are, I just read in the paper, because... because of the unanticipated expense of insuring all these people with insurance policies that mandate all kinds of tests and care, that the insurance companies are saying, we can't do this. We can't cover these people. They've flooded in the pool. They're very sick. They have a lot of problems, and they're breaking the back of the healthcare system.
They really, really are. And premiums keep going up, but now premiums are coming with larger deductibles. So even people who are paying their premiums, they can't afford to use the health insurance right. anyway because the deductible's too high.
But I don't want an insurance policy where I'm entitled to addiction counseling every year, lactation consultation. I don't really need that.
I don't think you need lactation consultation.
No. I mean, I have. It's been years since I've had lactation issues. So I'm past that point.
Okay. Our next question comes from Lewis. Good afternoon, Dr. Hoffman. Is there any treatment or surgery for my lazy eye on the right side? I'm 63 years old and an electronic engineer. Wow.
Amblyopia.
That's what it's
the
called?
Word, yeah. And so I don't know that much about it. There's certainly no nutritional therapy for it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a surgical problem, or perhaps it could be corrected with some sort of optical device. I mean, I know that amblyopia is treated sometimes in children with, I think it's treated with patching, you know, so that the eyes can, I don't know.
Get stronger? Patch one and patch the stronger one and the lazy one?
Don't quote me.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I sometimes see these kids, you know, these little kids with glasses, they have one smudged outside, and I think that's what they're treating.
A friend of mine had that because her...
It was a ocular dominance. It was trying to overcome a dominance that would cause one eye to atrophy, possibly, in its visual capacity. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the same thing.
No. Okay. Sorry, Lewis. All right, but best of luck for you. Best of luck to you, rather.
He should go to eyeadvisory.com. That's the Robert Abel website, who's been a guest on Intelligent Medicine. A-B-E-L. It's eyeadvisory.com. And perhaps there's a section talking about amblyopia.
Yeah. Okay. Our next question, we don't have a name here. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Can either of you discuss the dangers of a diet that's too high in fat? Besides the consequences of weight gain from extra calories and not buffering that with physical activity, yes, shame on me, but I'm working on it, are there any other health consequences even with the very high intake of healthy sources of fat?
Well, I know you're going to answer this in a second, but I think part of this comes from a semantic error that we make, which is people who are overweight go to doctors, and doctors say, you should go on a low-fat diet.
Still.
What they mean is you should go on a diet that doesn't make you fat.
Right.
And they go, low fat, like you're going to be low fat.
By eating low fat.
It's like, no fat shall pass my lips, no fat shall reach my hips.
Yeah.
But, so let's look at it in an open-minded way. What if a person were to subsist on a diet that was 80% fat? I mean, you couldn't really subsist on a 100% fat diet.
Like the Inuits?
Okay.
Yeah.
What? But there's some protein in that diet.
Yes.
But they're eating a lot of blubber.
Yeah.
They're literally eating blubber.
Mm-hmm. They are. Yeah.
And so what's the harm in that?
Well, if that's the only macronutrient, I would imagine they're going to be deficient in many other micronutrients as a result. We do need some protein in there. Yes, fats and proteins are absolutely essential macronutrients. Carbohydrates less so. However, eating too much fat, the fats to stay away from are the bad fats, the factory-made trans fats, the hydrogenated oils, all of that, the stuff in the Cinnabon and the Danish and the cake and all of that kind of stuff. But we can't go too far with healthy fat when it becomes too many calories. That will absolutely, on a low-carb, high-fat diet, if we take in too many calories every day, that will stall our weight loss efforts. So there is that danger, and we don't want to be overweight, obviously.
Right.
So, because that in itself is a danger.
And then the other issue, of course, is that fat, unfortunately, is a vehicle for environmental toxins.
Yes.
If you get the fat from animals that are, grazing on pesticide-laden...
corn and soy and all that.
Or graze near highways or being high on the food chain, they have a lot of PCBs from environmental toxicity in their fat.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with fish, mercury and or PCBs and the fat that you find in, older, larger fish like swordfish.
Yeah, that's true too. Swordfish, shark, tuna, king mackerel, tilefish. Those are basically the highest in
mercury. And Chilean sea.
Chilean sea bass.
Which is rare. It's rare that you actually get it. There's so much counterfeiting with Chilean sea basses that I don't know.
There's a lot of counterfeiting of seafood everywhere.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's not that regulated, but. Yes.
I'll have to go to Chile. It's on my bucket list to have actual Chilean sea bass, but I won't have too much because it's got a lot of mercury in it.
That's true. We'll just have it every once in a while. Take your chlorella. Take your metalloclear.
Right.
When you do that. Yeah. Yes, so you can. There are consequences of weight gain by eating too much fat that becomes, that goes into the caloric stratosphere for your metabolism.
Right.
Yes.
You know, I once observed that, you know, people would ask me about the Atkins diet. This is when I was a young practitioner across town from Atkins, and mm-hmm. Atkins was the guy who had a huge practice with like 75 people, and I had a little, you know, I was the upstart, you know, the newbie. And at that time, I was favoring more of a quasi-vegetarian diet. People would ask me about the Atkins diet. I would say, well, you know, there's no question the Atkins diet can help people lose weight. But it's also true that a very, very sharp samurai sword gives you the best shave. But if you use it improperly, you can slice your head off.
Yeah.
So what I meant by saying that is that the Atkins diet misinterpreted can be a problem because it had to be expertly applied because some people would acquire license to eat tons of fat.
They'll just eat a package of bacon.
They would say,
no, that's not the way to do this.
And then they would have their car, you know, like a few cookies. I mean, look, I'm not Atkins, but I'm going to have a few cookies. I have a little French bread. And that kindles the caloric potential of the fat.
Yeah.
So the way that you could lose weight with eating all that fat is by drastically restricting your carbohydrates.
Absolutely.
And if you don't do that, that fat plus mm-hmm. carbs thing is the perfect storm for weight gain.
Yes, yes.
So, again, it's like a exquisitely sharpened samurai sword.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be wielded expertly or else you can come to grievous harm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do we have time for a quick question? Is there such a thing?
A quick question?
So if we might...
this is a long one.
Okay,
this is about doomsday preppers.
Doomsday preppers. Well, let's tackle doomsday preppers.
Okay.
Because that's fun.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I love the show. Thank you very much. Talk show radio stations have a lot of advertising and discussions about prepper issues lately. It's easy to imagine being prepared with extra food and water, but how does a person accomplish having extra medication on hand when prescriptions are usually 3 months at most?
Right. So we can answer that very quickly,
mm-hmm.
is look at the percentage of Americans who are taking medications, especially Americans over 55 or 60.
Yeah.
Actually, I believe it is approximately 50% or the majority of Americans over 60 who take antihypertensive medications.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, what would happen if there's an electromagnetic pulse detonated in the upper atmosphere, destroying all communication and causing our civilization to go back to 1800. No medications, no ability to fill prescriptions. What would happen?
Mm.
And that's an interesting thought experiment, is that a lot of Americans are actually dependent on a daily basis for survival with their medications.
Sure.
On the other hand, sometimes when doctors go on strike in different parts of the world, less people die because medical interventions are associated with certain hazards.
Yeah.
So the answer is, if you are dependent on a medication, really, really dependent, and you are a serious doomsday prepper, you're going to stockpile that medication. Will that medication be fresh for a long period of time? Well, you know, if you're 50 years old and you want to live to 80 in a post-apocalyptic society and you need, for example, to be on a blood thinner,
mm-hmm.
Will you be able to sustain that? And the answer is probably not.
Yeah.
But, you know...
I'm just thinking of a diabetic on insulin. Oof.
Well, there are very few instances of medications that literally, on a day-to-day basis, are life-sustaining.
Yeah.
Insulin is an example of which. Most medications, if you didn't take them, you'd be at higher risk of dying,
mm-hmm.
but only somewhat higher risk of dying. Or ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, you might be better off. You know, we could see some people being better off. You know, they'd have to get off five medications and might discover that because of food shortages and the need to do physical work, that they're healthier. But, you know, sometimes late at night,
That would be a great scenario right there, what you just said.
Well, it's sometimes late at night, you think of this scenario of a lot of people who are really dependent on the accoutrements of civilization. Mm-hmm. And what would happen is there would be, I think, widespread death and disease. No antibiotics, no sanitation, no communication, no hospitals. Doctors like me, I'd have to learn how to treat people with no medicine. I'd have to learn how to treat wounds with poultices. Mm-hmm. I'd have to treat, almost go back to, sort of an ancient folk medicine to treat people. And by the way, there wouldn't be any vitamins either.
No. Wow.
Although vitamins have pretty good shelf life. But
that's true, yeah. Wow. Great question.
On that note, on that positive note, let's conclude today's broadcast and hope that we're back again next week for Q&A with Layla. Otherwise, we'll send up smoke signals, and you can meet me at my designated shelter, whose location I will not divulge. But if you're extra special nice, I'll let you know, and I'll let you in the hatch. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Layla Mutin, this is our weekly Q&A with Layla. Thanks for joining us.